You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA's Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity, trying to bring you good content. We're glad you're here. Thanks for listening, and we hope you've subscribed. Now, we're going to enter our series tonight on national security issues that we're facing due to the rapid development of AI, the need for data storage centers, the need for advanced battery technology, and looming on the horizon is the issue of quantum computing. Our energy needs are shifting, and they're shifting dramatically, and they're at tension, obviously, with our desire to protect the environment. But it would be crazy to think that this is not a national security issue that is rich for discussion. As we're recording, we just want to acknowledge that the market value of tech stocks took a dive in the weeks after it was announced that Chinese startup called DeepThink was being downloaded more than any other large language model like ChatGPT from the app stores for both Android and iOS operating systems. We don't know if these numbers are accurate or if they're somehow inflated, but what we do know is that it was reported that DeepThink used less computing power for its large language model. It was less than ChatGPT. We're not sure whether that's accurate either. But a big part of the discussion about energy will have to do with something called critical minerals. Now, tonight, we're speaking to Tommy Beaudreau, who is the former Deputy Secretary of the Interior, now with the law firm of WilmerHale. He's an unusual guest in that he grew up in an oil town in Alaska. Is that true, Tommy? Like Prudhoe Bay or one of those?
Well, I grew up in Anchorage. My father worked on the North Slope in Prudhoe Bay.
That is so interesting and a completely separate conversation. We're going to link the rest of Tommy's impressive bio, but we're super glad that you're here. Thanks for joining us tonight, Tommy.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's lay a baseline for our listeners who may be interested in this. They may be young. They may not be clear on what a critical mineral is exactly and who decides what becomes a critical mineral.
Well, for anyone who is confused about what a critical mineral is, they should not feel bad about that. There's actually a lot of confusion about the terminology and your point about who decides and what's critical or not. Even the term critical mineral becomes a bit of a misnomer. One way to think about it is non-fuel material. Nuclear energy type fuels generally aren't included in this discussion, as important as they are to expanding our capacity to generate electricity, including carbon-free electricity. And so while uranium, et cetera, are critical to our economy and emerging issues, they're not really within the scope of this specific discussion. Another way to think about what a critical mineral is material that are essential to emerging fields of technological development, as well as expansion of the electric grid and battery storage and capacity. And so those materials include some metals that we think of as quite common, nickel, copper, et cetera. Others that we hear a lot about as emerging necessary materials for battery storage, like lithium, cobalt, graphite. While there is a kind of raging debate about what material goes on the list and shouldn't copper be on the list because it's really important to energy transition and building out the grid, et cetera, those are a little bit of distractions. The real issue is, you know, what are the materials we need in order to facilitate energy transition, technological development, and meeting national and global energy needs?
And a piece of that, obviously, is our national security needs. Why don't we talk about that specifically? What are some of the minerals essential to our national security needs, as well as our sort of everyday quality of life?
Even these kind of everyday quality of life activities and thoughts about energy and energy security have direct interplay with the broader national security imperatives. A lot of these materials are outside of anybody's controlling in the sense of where they're located. That's a factor of geology and not political boundaries. And so as we think about energy security, as we think about the United States' place in intensifying global competition across a number of markets, and we think about our competition, to put it in, the most sort of benign light, with adversaries like China, even issues like energy supply, energy transition, take on these national security dimensions. And so it is something that's familiar to a lot of Americans thinking about oil and fossil fuel supply in a national security dimension, our relationship with the Middle East and other regions of the world. But critical minerals has a similar national security dimension to it as we think about energy transition, emerging technology, economic competition, and, global trade and security structures.
I think it's also the case that as we move into advanced AI systems with respect to our weaponry, much of which is now drones, it's less sort of boots on the ground. These critical minerals are essential to a lot of the chips, frankly, that we use. And I know we've had other podcasts where we've talked about that. One of the issues that I know that you think about a lot is this concept of sourcing. Can you just explain what you mean by the concept of sourcing and why this is an issue in any discussion of critical minerals?
So the critical minerals problem has a number of dimensions to it. The first that people often think about is sourcing, which goes back to that geological question of, where are the deposits? And of course, some of those deposits are in North America, in the United States, in Canada, and with countries that we are allied with and have good security relationships as well as trade relationships. Many of the materials, not surprisingly, are in locations that don't fit those criteria, including China, Russia, areas in Africa that we need to develop additional, relationships with and presence. And so sourcing becomes a threshold issue of access to the materials from a mining perspective. And that's why so much of this conversation tends to focus on mining and access. Again, to take it back to like a kind of fossil fuel analogy, there's been historically over the decades a lot of talk about access to fossil fuel production, the United States increasing its ability to produce fossil fuels domestically. The same sort of issues arise in the context of critical minerals. One dimension of it, which my friend Daniel Yergin talks about, is, big shovels. Then we need additional mineral production in order to keep pace, not only with, the energy and technological issues, but also fundamentally the national security issues and whether we have reliable, stable, secure sources for these materials.
Just to break it down into what I would call a teenager's understanding of things, these things are under the ground and they tend to be a lot of them in places where we're either in competition, like you mentioned China, in economic and sort of existential competition, if you will. And then you mentioned Africa, which I think has a history of sort of fewer democratic institutions maybe and fairer dealings than we would like and then would make them reliable. But you're also emphasizing, if I get you correctly, that having a relationship with these countries is necessary. Like there's massive infrastructure needed to be able, and only a few companies can do this. Like who has the capability to go into these places and begin these extractions, which require our massive undertakings, becomes limited. It's not going to be like a startup guy sitting on his couch somewhere saying, I'm just going to go into fill in the blank African country and I'm going to begin mining this material. It simply does not work that way. You have to have a lot of infrastructure, a lot of equipment, a lot of people, a lot of expertise. And it doesn't lend itself to sort of a small business model, but we can talk a little bit about the bigs. And in order to come into a country with that kind of stuff, somehow you've got to build trust, right, to start with. So can you talk about the kinds of mining, like what does it take to get these minerals where they are?
Excellent points about economies of scale and technology in the mining sector. And one dimension of that is also the types of materials that traditionally have been the focus of the mining industry. And there's a little bit of the story of why America's place in critical minerals development comes out of that history. And so, as you pointed out right off the top, you know, when we talk about critical minerals, we're talking about lithium, nickel, cobalt, copper, et cetera. Categories of materials that we're not talking about are like precious metals. So gold, silver, a lot of the materials that are actually still the focus of a lot of the mining industry, including in North America and the United States and Canada. A lot of our, you know, U.S. operators and a lot of the mines on American public lands are really gold mines, you know, to this day. And that is a very different technology and a very different industry from critical minerals. The other dimension of it, which you touch on, which goes to some of the barriers to critical minerals development, particularly in a secure way, is it's one thing to extract the materials. It's one thing to gain that type of access. It's one thing to build and develop a mine that can operate safely in an environmentally responsible way and in a socially responsible way. The other dimension is processing. That's actually, in my view, the more challenging area than the upstream sourcing. And that is an area that China, in particular, has a true stranglehold. So it's one thing to extract the ore. Mining and the extraction of critical minerals is actually an incredibly intensive processing effort. And so you take the raw ore out, even copper, it's not like, you know, there's chunks of that metal. All of it requires substantial smelting and refining. And frankly, China has a stranglehold on that midstream processing in a way that outpaces even the sourcing issues. And so while I agree totally with the idea that we need secure sourcing and we need to put more resources into developing that type of access and development on the upstream side, the real conundrum and the real puzzle is on the processing side. So even today in North America, materials that are mined at home still largely need to be sent overseas for processing. And that's where, again, the Chinese chokehold on these materials really comes into effect.
Let's look at that through the lens of just copper. You need a smelter, right, to process this copper, which doesn't look like the wires that you see in the telegraph lines or whatever, the ones that everybody seems to like to steal now, because obviously you can sell them for a lot of money.
They're critical.
They're critical. But just explain, like, kind of break this down for people, because I think lawyers are at their best when they have good facts, right? Good facts and good law and all that. But what the heck is a smelter? Why don't we have them? Do we have them? Do we have enough of them? What makes it both legally and sort of socially a fact that we are not controlling this? With a lot of technology that we talk about, we developed it.
Yeah. So when a copper mine is built and production starts, it's literally just taking like huge chunks of ore body and rock out of the mine. A very small percentage of that ore body is actual copper, right? And there's a lot of geology and evaluation that goes into the quality of an ore body based on, you know, what that percentage is. But even if it were like 10%, say, that is an incredibly rich ore deposit, but it's still 90% of stuff that's not copper. And the way you refine that ore is a combination of heat and chemicals. And so what a smelter is a processing facility that takes, you know, that raw ore body and through a combination of chemical and heat application, extracts the usable copper material out of those rocks. That is a intensive industrial and in some ways, not pleasant process. Again, it's energy intensive and there's environmental effects associated with smelting. And so for the reasons that you said, over a period of decades. This is not a recent development. It's kind of global mineral supply chain system has evolved over a period of, 40, 50 years to essentially outsource that smelting and processing capability to places like China, which are extremely dominant. And so, for example, in North America, there's really only two smelters at scale currently operating in North America. There's some smaller, like localized ones, but there's only two facilities at scale in North America. One's in Utah and one's in Quebec. And so even though I agree with and support the current emphasis on new mines, new sources in the US and Canada, you still run headlong into this processing issue of, what do you do with the ore body once you get it out of the ground? Some of the initiatives that we've seen very early on out of the Trump administration, shining a light on these issues and focus, I think have a lot of potential to tackle this kind of midstream processing issue. But again, it's one that has, as you pointed out, taken shape over a period of decades and therefore is not an issue that can be addressed in a matter of, months or years. It's going to take a fundamental reordering and a lot of investment to make the processing part of the supply chain more reliable.
It sounds super dirty. And one of the things I think happens in the United States is there's a lot of talk about, United States innovates, Europe regulates, China, they do whatever the heck they CCP wants. But I think there's also in the United States, people don't want that stuff near them. I can only tell you, part of my family comes from sort of the Appalachian foothills, the Piedmont part of North Carolina, where there was a lot of strip mining. And I don't think they want that around them anymore. They like the idea of the jobs and the economic benefit, but what they don't want is, they don't want the cancer clusters or whatever they believe could ensue. I wonder if a part of this too is just figuring out where these things can even occur physically within the boundaries of the United States in such a way that we get what we need and then we don't harm what I consider somewhat already vulnerable rural populations that maybe aren't always welcoming of some of this. What, do you have any thoughts on sort of that angle?
Yeah, I think there's no question that that's true. There is, as you pointed out, an economic component to it based on just sort of the invisible hand of capitalism finding, where refining can happen in the lowest cost, most efficient way. But there's no question that part of that low cost efficiency calculation has to do with environmental externalities. What type of facility under environmental regulations that would be found acceptable in the United States would have to be constructed here relative to someplace like China, where you point out those types of issues are not valued necessarily in the same way. That is an issue that if the United States and our close allies and partners want to seriously address, we're going to have to confront that issue of what are the environmental consequences of, again, this heavily, heavily industrialized and, as you point out, sometimes very unpleasant activity. It's the same, with the fossil fuel sector and oil and gas refining. Those are intensive petrochem facilities. Smelting is, a similar process. The concept of wanting to onshore that activity makes a lot of intuitive sense, but when folks are kind of confronted with it in their backyard, it's likely to, at a minimum, raise a lot of siting and permitting and potential environmental controversy. And that is part of the overall legacy and context for mining activity in general, including in the United States, where there is a history and legacy from the extraction side, communities, including tribal communities, bearing the environmental consequences of mining activity without necessarily seeing the economic benefits. And that has changed, and there are things about that that are changing, but onshoring the processing will raise a lot of similar issues about, impacts on fence line communities, et cetera.
Yeah, and I would say a lot of the lawyers today are the generation that read and saw the movie Aaron Brockovich about, I guess that's the Salton Sea, maybe the lithium mining there and sort of what happened to the community. I think they're scared because they would need some reassurance about how these things would be executed in such a way that it wouldn't, you know, sort of make them sick or drive the price of their homes into the ground.
Which introduces a regulatory cost factor that doesn't need to be addressed in the same way when that activity is being outsourced to, you know, places like China.
Yeah, and I would imagine the current administration is factoring that in as they do things like tariffs and look for ways to avoid sort of a level of retaliation that might be incapacitating to national security or just the tech industry, which now employs, you know, what, 500,000 people. So what does the PRC do to make it difficult to manage sort of fair access to critical minerals? Because I know, I forget what it is, but I know I've been told that there are one or two that only can be extracted within their territorial boundaries. And let's talk a little bit about sort of their concept of fair play and what they will do to get a leg up in the global markets. Because at times, doesn't look too fair, I think, to Americans.
So much of the conversation is about sourcing and access, but you know, you touch on now a third dimension of it, which is the integrity and transparency and effectiveness of markets and how that influences capital expenditures from Western mining companies. There are materials, and again, you know, another category or subset even beyond, you know, critical minerals that you hear a lot about are like rare earths, more exotic materials that are important for technology development, but also national security because they get integrated into advanced aviation and weapon systems. That's a factor of geology, and China does control, even has close to dominance on rare earths, you know, these more exotic materials, and then more mundane materials in the sense that it's just carbon, but also essential to advanced technologies associated with batteries, including things like graphite. Those are, as you point out, categories of materials that China not only has a lot of control over in terms of access and processing, but also the ability to manipulate markets. Even as we look towards sourcing new mines for materials in friendlier jurisdictions, China does have a record of economic manipulation. So as soon as they catch wind that a new nickel mine is going to open up in Australia, all of a sudden, they're able to manipulate the price of nickel and drive it down to the point where capital investment, Western-style capital investment, becomes difficult to subscribe.
That is fascinating to me. So what do? Do they just flood the market with nickel? What are some of the tools that they use to undermine our effort?
So they can flood the market because they do have a ability to dial in production, but there's also not a lot of price transparency, right? Even through artificial means, they can essentially just set market price on refined materials in a way that is not reflective of actual supply and demand factors, but they can literally just manipulate markets. So some of it is adjusting output and, you know, supply and demand factors, but some of it's literally they can just put out material at a certain price, refined material in particular, and affect market that way. And then there's the familiar issues around, you know, currency, et cetera, that have been a source of tension with China in particular from a trade standpoint.
Can you just mention the familiar issues around currency, what you mean by that? Not everybody who's listening may be aware of that. And I think it bears some explanation.
Yeah, you know, one of the longstanding and valid grievances that the United States has had relative to China on the inequities of global trading systems and supply chain is, you know, the ability of China as a centralized economy to affect the value of its currency in a way that is much more subject to manipulation than traditional Western currency, since they can affect and drive down costs relative to U.S. market-based manufacturers simply by setting currency rates in a way that are not economic, but have economic and strategic advantage that they use to affect how supply chains work.
And just let me quote, if I might, the Financial Times on sort of the issue of some of the nonsense that China can engage in willy-nilly without, you know, any democratic sort of checks or balances. But they reported that China has built up control of critical minerals across the developing world over the course of 2 decades. So long-term thinking.
Which, again, I think is understated, actually. I think they've done it over a much longer time horizon than even 2 decades.
Because 2 decades feels pretty short. That just takes us back a little tiny bit through a network of 26 state-backed financial institutions. China issued loans worth $57 billion from 2000 to 2021 in 19 low and middle-income countries for mining and processing copper, cobalt, nickel, lithium, and rare earths, components critical to clean energy such as electric vehicle batteries and solar panels. Research shows that more than 3/4 of the PRC transaction mineral financing in the developing world was pushed to Chinese entities. That's 75%, listeners, who set up so-called joint ventures. So you call something a joint venture, apparently it is, and special purpose vehicles. These obviously are not, they report, the same as China's Belt and Road projects, which are a sort of a separate global land grab, long-term thinking, you know, let's get control of ports, minerals and food supply and everything. What do we do about that?
So I think that captures in a very concise way a lot of the challenges that we've been talking about. And, you know, again, the FT piece that you quote points out that this isn't just about sourcing, that it is about processing and their ability to engage in economically coercive measures to suppress prices, manipulate markets, and take advantage of developing countries in a way that the United States and Europe, I think, have made a concerted effort to stand up to and to challenge and ameliorate. But all of the statistics that you included in the Financial Times report, I think, gives true flavor for the scale of the challenges here. And that while U.S. policy in this space, including trade policy, including a number of the levers pointed out in the Trump administration's executive orders, are useful tools, this is an area that cannot be undone or reversed or restructured overnight, because it has set in over a time scale that essentially goes back to just kind of the post-World War II ordering of, you know, global economy and supply chain and manufacturing, with an additional gloss on it of economic manipulation and coercion.
Yeah, that's a massive issue. I don't know, absent massive changes inside China, how we actually deal with that, to be honest. As I listen to you, it feels to me like unless China changes something internally, this will be sort of the epic ongoing battle of the remainder of certainly our lifetimes and certainly that of our children. Because I think it just does not feel as if there would be any incentive on the part of China to ever change any of this. I hear no market incentive. They certainly have no internal political incentive when you're talking about a country of over a billion people that you're trying to keep stable in over a large geographic territory. I just don't know how this all plays out. I want to see a path forward.
Hey, podcast listeners, this is Holly, and tagging on to Elise's great discussion, just to remind you all that the committee is now accepting nominations for the Morris Liebman Award. The deadline is March 14. We'll link to the nomination form in the reference section. But as some background, the Liebman Award in Law and National Security was established by our committee, which honors the memory of Morris Liebman, a distinguished lawyer, co-founder of our committee, and recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The award recognizes Morris Liebman's lifelong dedication to the rule of law, leadership in the field of law and national security affairs, and continuing support for those engaged in this field. Persons eligible for this award must have demonstrated a sustained commitment and made contributions to the field of law and national security, whether through government service, legal scholarship, or otherwise. Again, we'll link to the nomination form in the reference section of this podcast, along with a list of past recipients. Remember, the deadline is March 14th.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.